Thank you so much for coming. I appreciate that. My name is Mike Cope, and my title at Pepperdine is the Director of Ministry Outreach. You don't see me here much because we live in Abilene, Texas. I think I'm the only person offered a chance to live in Malibu who chose Abilene, but it's where grandchildren are, kind of a long story, where I spent my life in ministry. And I'm now, among the jobs, is leading the Pepperdine Bible Lectures. I'm so sorry for those of you who come to this each year, because the previous years I was able to get my featured guests here early. Last year, the greatest Bible scholar in the world, to me, N.T. Wright, came and spoke. And the year before that, Kent Brantley did, you know, just as he was Time Magazine Man of the Year, and I kept checking, thinking, who can we do? And the answer was nobody, and you got stuck with me. Sorry about that. But it does give me a chance to share with you a little bit about what I'm thinking about lectures, because my dear friend Jerry Rushford led it for 30 years, and it's taken a little different turn that I think's in continuity with what Jerry did. You can tell it's lectureship time because the parking's gone. And there are more Southern accents out there, and people hold a hello gaze just a little too long. We Texans and Southerners don't know boundaries very well, but for a couple days here this week, we'll enjoy having these guests. They're on their way here. All my family's on the way. My older son and two-year-old grandson got in at midnight last night. The rest of his family's coming. The younger son's coming. This poor guy comes every year, and he sent this picture from a hospital that he and his wife were driving here, and he got bit by a rattlesnake. And but his note says, I will be delayed a bit getting the Pepperdine Bible Lectures. And I know what was happening. The next one is a picture I've actually taken. The closest rest stop to Abilene, Texas, has this sign on it. So you know you're in Texas when there are rattlesnake signs as you head to the bathroom. I'm afraid that's maybe what happened to that guy. So our theme this year is spiritual rhythms, and I'm just going to talk about that theme a little bit. But first, I wanted to tell a little about my experience coming here through the years, since I was in ministry my whole life. My first year to come was 1986, long before some of you were born here. That was my first year, and back then, every speaker wore a dark suit and a tie, every male speaker. Women who were speaking wore dresses. And so my first year, I flew into LAX in my dark suit, my starched white shirt and my tie, picked up by a Pepperdine student. Back then, we sent students to LAX to pick up every speaker in a shuttle. We don't do that anymore. You know, it's the world of Uber and Lyft and so on. We figure they can get here. But he picked me up, picked up seven of us. It was seven men in dark suits. This young Pepperdine student was a little frazzled. I mean, he just learned how to drive a shuttle the day before, I think, you know. And he had not thought to put gas in it. And so the first thing he said is, I just realized I don't have any gas. And so we were trying to get to the closest gas station, and I promise this happened. He ran out of gas on Sepulveda Boulevard. So the seven of us in our dark suits got out, and we pushed him about a block and a half on Sepulveda. He pulled into a gas station, and that's when it hit him. He did not have a dime in his pocket. So we pooled our money to buy a little gas. And we got some gas, and as we were leaving, he panicked, and instead of putting it in drive, put it in reverse and slammed into a gas pump. That was my first year here. I told our 200 Pepperdine student workers that story yesterday. When I was done, one of the students came up to me and said, was that man's name Bob Perez? And I said, yes, but how do you know? He said, I'm his son. And he said, I know that's the right story because my dad tells it everywhere too. So, and that's when it hit me. That was a long time ago, you know. That was a long time ago. So we've got all these students activated, and we're ready to receive these guests. But back then, the focus was on lectures, and it still carries that name. Stay tuned. Some of that's going to change very quickly. But the name is the Pepperdine Bible Lectures. Now, for me, that's full of warm fuzzies. It's an age thing, I guess, and because I grew up with it. But for my boys, and then I'm sure before long with my grandchildren, that won't be a particularly warm idea. That you really go someplace for lectures from morning to evening. You know, that sounds punitive to them. And that was the focus, but it was an interesting time. The denomination associated with this university, Churches of Christ, it was a big time of transition in the 1980s and 90s. And so it became a gathering point for leaders from that church from all over the world to come. But for me, the focus now is not so much on lectures per se, though I'm all about content and biblical teaching and so on, but the experience. And it grows in part out of my life as a minister. I loved being a minister, but it was not easy. There were challenges in ministry, and there were challenges in our life. We went through waves of loss. Our 10-year-old daughter died. And then my nephew died. And then there was a horrible wreck at our church. Some of you have met Jeff Walling, who works in my office now. Jeff was speaking many years ago in Dallas, and we sent 100 teenagers from our church in SUVs, and 11 of the 12 came back. But the one with my younger son didn't come back. It went for a twirl on I-20, killing the boy next to him, injuring him badly. So it was the third wave. And as some of you know, when that happens, every relationship in your life is not off. You know, you idealistically think, wow, that'd bring a couple together. Well, it does and it doesn't. You grieve on your own time. And sometimes that person's face reminds you of your deepest loss. And so as I limped to this campus through the decades, it was for me not for lectures primarily. In fact, when Andy Benton offered me the job, I said, Andy, full disclosure, I'm not really known for attending anything. I come, but I don't attend a lot. And he said, I know that, but I also know that you came. So for me, coming out here was some lectures, but it was more about community and finding older friends to mentor me. It was about going to the beach and every day going to the Sarah Retreat Center to walk the Stations of the Cross. And it became for me a place of healing through the years. Or the language that I like to use is that it was for me a harbor. Because in a harbor, you find protection from the storm for a period of time, but you also get refueled so you can go back out into the storm. And the Pepperdine Bible lectures did for me. So what Rick and I and our team are trying to do is shift this a little bit so that we keep the best of that tradition, but expand it into all those things that help heal people. So now, 7:30 tomorrow morning, there'll be a CrossFit class, which worries me that somebody out here thinks that hiking up and down these hills is not enough fitness, you know, so I don't know what kind of hardcore class that's going to be. We have excursions to the Getty Museum. We have photograph hiking. We have nature hikes. We had just today, Rick finished meeting with a group of ministers to give them a chance to hear each other and speak. We've got another group this afternoon where older ministers are meeting with younger ministers just to try to help them work through some things. And not everybody who comes here is a minister, but most are probably church leaders in one sense or another. I always think it's like a boxing match, that when you come into your corner and you're bloodied and you think you can't go on, somebody's there with the smelling salt and the towel and words of encouragement and a little massage, and they send you back out. And that's kind of what we want to do. I had, after that third wave of grief hit, my body just, psychosomatic stuff took over, and I thought I was dying. My body just couldn't respond to that much grief. And an older man in our church, an elder, had been a lifelong physical therapist. And he said, I think you need to come see me. And so every week for about a year, I'd go in and he would anoint me with oil, which was a little outside my experience. And he'd pray over me. And then he'd do what physical therapists do, which is make you hurt a little bit until it feels better. And what I found at the end of that year is there was a kind of healing to my body, though I don't know exactly, was it the anointing, was it the prayer, was it the stretching, or was it the presence of an older guy giving me guidance in life, and probably it was all of those. But that, again, is what I'm hoping this can be. And we want you to feel welcome and invited. It's not just that you're here in your offices. I know there are jobs to do, but I'd love for you to feel like you could slip out at times. A few of the things that I'll mention that might be fun. Some of you have heard Bob Goff before. Bob always mentions in his bio that he is an adjunct professor for the Pepperdine Law School, but I've not been able to have him yet. But tomorrow morning in the field house, Bob will be speaking. Above Bob is Suzanne Stabile. If you've ever done any work in the Enneagram, kind of a more, some describe it as a more spiritual version of the Myers-Briggs personality test, then she and Ian Cron Morgan are leading the way in that. They've got a podcast, a website, a new book. And Ian has already come, but Suzanne is going to be coming. I think she's in here every afternoon at 3:30, as I recall, to talk about the Enneagram and what one learns. The upper right corner is Peter Enns. Man, I've had been able to invite some of my favorite Bible scholars. Walter Brueggemann's my favorite Old Testament scholar. N.T. Wright, as I said, New Testament. Peter Enns is a guide for people who I think are struggling with how does one read the Bible in this world in which we live in. What does that mean? What do you do with doubts? Sometimes in religious context, doubts are the kind of things you just sweep under the rug and pretend nobody sees. But Pete's very boldly telling people, no, those doubts may be the very key to a deeper, richer faith in your life. And then the Hacksaw Ridge, I wanted to mention that Craig Detweiler has this phenomenal class lined up. He's got the producer of Hacksaw Ridge coming, the producer of The Shack coming, the executive producer of Silence coming, all Pepperdine grads, and he'll have an interaction with them about what they hope will happen in culture through these movies and the whole that whole arts and media. But, you know, there are hundreds of classes, and I just picked a few here to spotlight. I'd love for you, we've got our Bible app. Some of you have seen these around. We'd love for you to find something if you'd like to attend. But I thought just very briefly I might give you a rundown on what was going through my mind with this theme. Because most years you're focused on one book of the Bible or one theme. And this year it's on five books of the Bible. But there are five shorter books that usually don't get treated. But they came together in Jewish history and became known as the Scrolls, or the Megilloth, which is the Hebrew word for scrolls. So these five books were woven together and had a special place because they got tied to the rhythm of the calendar. So every year, through the centuries, at Passover, when the family was gathering, they would read the Song of Solomon, which, if you've ever read it, feels like that'd be awkward with Grandma in the room, you know? But the whole family's gathered there, and you read the Song of Songs. Then, several weeks later, at Pentecost, a barley harvest celebration, you read the book that's about barley harvest. You read the book of Ruth. And then in the middle of summer, the ninth of Ab, a time to remember the fall of Jerusalem, another Jewish atrocities. You read, of course, Lamentations, the great agony and grief over the fall of God's city. In the fall, at Tabernacles, when all the families are going outside and setting up tents, you read Ecclesiastes. And then, when Purim comes, you, of course, would read Esther, because that's where we know about the celebration of Purim. And that's how we're building the theme lessons this year. A lot of the classes are looking through these five books, not all of them by any means, but maybe a fourth of the classes are delving into all of these books. And then the plenary sessions will focus on them. So one by one, I want to tell you what I think the rhythm is that's involved in these books. So the Song of Songs is this awkward book. I taught freshman Bible for 15 years at Abilene Christian University while I was preaching. And there was always this interest in the Song of Solomon and always this kind of, I don't really want to hear an old preacher talk to me about it sense. But the fact that there is a book in the Bible that is erotic. The funny thing is that for us, erotic is, we picture that in thesaurus next to pornography. But that's not what erotic is. Eros, the Greek word eros, is one of the words for love, and it's the kind of love that's about desire. And as some of you know who've been reading the works of James K.A. Smith, that's a big movement in Christian education, is to realize Descartes was not right. Descartes said, I think, what? Therefore I am. And a lot of educational models are built on that. A kind of modern version is, no, I feel, therefore I am. And this kind of swing in the middle here says, no, I desire, and therefore I am. What I want, what I love, what I set my heart on, what I focus my passions on, that determines who I am. Everything else will fall in with that. It's Augustine's prayer in his Confessions. You have made us for your own, and our souls are restless until they rest in thee. That if you want to know who I am, you have to start asking what the eros is. What's the focus of my desire? Those other kinds of loves, they will fall in based on where my attachments are. Now, specifically in the Song of Songs, we're talking about the kind of erotic love that is sexual. It's this long explanation of the anticipation of the wedding night, which promises to be a pretty good one. And then it's reflections on that night. And through the book, you've got all these descriptions of each other. Now, ironically, for 19 centuries, the church said, oh, it's allegory. And so they went through these passages and said, no, this can't be about that. This is about God and Israel, or Christ and the church, these passionate love poems here. And part of that may have been there was an awkwardness about sex, though I think it's much more than that I'll come back to in a minute. But I grew up in a church that would have never read the Song of Solomon. But we had hymns that came from that interpretation of the book. The first one, she says, I am a rose of Sharon. Now, most of you here didn't grow up with this song, but I grew up singing, Jesus, rose of Sharon, bloom within my heart. I can still remember Grandma Cope singing, Jesus, rose of Sharon. If Grandma Cope had any idea what this passage was about, she would have not made it through the service. Or after that, like a lily among the thorns, he's the lily of the valley, the bright and morning star, my church sang growing up, taken from that interpretation of the Song of Songs. Or here's one maybe you do know. It's a little different the way I've translated it here. But any of you grew up singing, he invites us into his banqueting table and his banner over us is love. Yeah, I see a lot of heads nodding. Wow, I don't want to destroy a good children's song here. But first of all, he didn't take her into the banquet. It says in Hebrew, he took her into the Beth Yayin. He took her into the house of wine. And this is not a real God's banner over says love. I love that image, but this is sexual imagery here. He took her into the house of wine, and afterwards, she's wanting food and she's tired. I mean, it's just like the rest of the book. There's a flow here to the erotic desires. It's funny that there are passages in the book that I love that somebody has made memes of it. Like, he looks at her and says, your waist is a mound of wheat. Now, how that never made it on a Hallmark card, I don't know, you know. But somebody's put together a series of Ryan Gosling memes, you know, with this as if to show just how funny all of this is to us. But in their time, in their language, she describes him in graphic terms, and he describes her in graphic terms. And the funny thing is, it's right there in the Bible. It's part of this rhythm of relationship. I always say, to me, this is like, some of you know who Allie Hewson is, Irish businesswoman. To me, it's like all the poetry's written about Allie Hewson. The greatest love poetry of my life, maybe, has been written about this woman because her husband, Paul Hewson, a.k.a. Bono, writes all of these songs where I think, wow, that's about Allie. And then I think, oh, wait, no, that's about God. That's about Jesus. It's a song for someone, with or without you. Just on and on it goes. And when he's been interviewed, it depends on the day as to what he's talking about. That for Bono, the love of one spills into the love of another. And there was one that I thought, okay, that one absolutely is for sure about Allie. But then Bono found out that Joey Ramone, it was the last song he listened to on his deathbed. And Bono said, but even that song is gospel. It's because these meld back and forth, the 39 years of marriage that I have with Diane, is a kind of intimacy that points beyond itself to a deeper intimacy. The intimacy that's there, that's kind of built on this common building of life, that you don't hit the ejection button, you last through these hard times, you learn to desire and love each other, even in grief. That itself in its imperfections points to God. And that's why I don't say that for 19 centuries the church was stupid. It's not that. It's that they knew that these erotic desires are related, that whatever I experience with Diane is but a reflection of the deeper, ultimate longing my soul has for God. And so I really don't mind singing He's the Lily of the Valley and Jesus Rose of Sharon. I think it's probably better that people singing it don't know what that imagery is all about. But I do think back and forth, intimacy is there. And so what I've said is that, let's see, go to the next one. This is the rhythm of relationship. That as I live in my life, the Song of Songs teaches me that this intimacy is connected. It's a beautiful passage. Place me like a seal over your heart, chapter 8, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. And the picture's not very big, but I snapped that one of my parents not long ago. My dad has advanced Parkinson's, and my mom was very ill in the hospital. Dad drove us all crazy because he needed to get in there to see her, you know, which creates its own set of problems because he's not mobile, but he was going to get in there. And just, you can kind of see there was this ET moment where they reached and touched. And I thought, well, through the years, you know, intimacy's taken different looks, but that's what it is there. And according to Song of Songs, that's a part of this deeper, richer connection with God. Second, the book of Ruth, which they read at Pentecost. Ruth is about the importance of just a normal, average life, because this book, I think I've got a quote in here, this book doesn't have, there are no outstanding, historically prominent figures in Ruth, no splendid kings, no charismatic judges, no fiery prophets. It's a plain story about two widows and a farmer whose lives are woven into the fabric of God's salvation through the ordinary actions of common life. By the way, I forgot to mention that back in the late 80s, I read a book by Eugene Peterson, the guy that gave us The Message, called Five Smooth Stones for Pastoral Work. And in that book, he explained the Megilloth and what they have to say today. And that's been in the back of my mind all these decades. I tried to get Eugene here, but couldn't. He's 86 and not moving out of Montana. But he loved that we're doing this. But in Ruth, you have a figure who's kind of the female counterpart to Job in the Old Testament, and her name's Naomi. Because in five verses, everything that can fall apart falls apart. Grief comes wave after wave. And it begins with famine. Now we today know what to do with famine. You know, we've got technology, and we've had drought in California from 2011 until just recently. But back then, you didn't have that safety net. And so when you think famine, you think of distended bellies and emaciated ribs. And all these families sitting around thinking, can we last one more year? And Naomi and Elimelech decide they can't last. And so they leave Bethlehem and they go to the worst place imaginable in the Old Testament, which is Moab. Moab, which began from an incestuous relationship between Lot and his older daughter. In fact, Deuteronomy 23 says, no Israelite is ever to be among a Moabite. And I always say, it's important to know the law well so you know when to break the law. Principle I don't like, but neither do the Pharisees. But apparently it's true here. They go to be among the Moabites. And then Elimelech dies. And it leaves Naomi in the sisterhood of suffering, a widow vulnerable in a foreign land. But at least she's got two sons, Chilion and Mahlon. But who are they going to marry? It's not exactly every Jewish mother's dream to have your boys grow up and marry a Moabite, but that's who's there, so they marry. Mahlon marries Ruth. Chilion marries Orpah. But nobody can get pregnant. 10 years. And I think, okay, do the math. 10 years times two women times 12 months a year, that's 240 disappointments. And then the thing I almost can't bring myself to speak, her two sons die. And so now we have three vulnerable women in Moab. And Naomi says, let's go back home. But somewhere along the way, she sends them home. Both refuse. And finally, Orpah goes. And that's that beautiful statement where Ruth says, where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. It's a conversion story. And where they bury you, they will bury me. What a beautiful... Most of you are too young to know this, but back in the 1980s, every wedding I performed, they sang that song. Have you ever even heard it? Whither thou goest, I will go. And the problem was, they always had it for the husband, the bride, and the groom. One time I wanted to see the young woman turn to her future mother-in-law and sing it. Because that's what it is here. It's this love and this commitment. Well, they go and they meet a kinsman redeemer named Boaz. The law made sure that widows and the poor and immigrants were taken care of. And so when you went and you threshed your wheat, if you missed some, you just left it there. That's for the poor. If you drop some while you're putting it together, you leave it there. That's for the poor. And our way of thinking, this land is your land, this land is my land, and their way of thinking, this land is God's land. I'm just kind of farming it for him. And God's going to take care of the poor. So Ruth is out there working, and she meets Boaz, who realizes this incredible commitment she's made to somebody from a whole other nationality, this Israelite woman named Naomi. And then the next thing you know, they're married, and at the end of the book, you have this baby, Obed, who has a baby named Jesse, who has a baby named David, so you have a royal line at the end, but that's not the story. The story is just this ordinary movement of how God is in and out of lives. And the funny thing is, God isn't even mentioned much in the book. But for people like most of us, my obituary is never going to be in the New York Times. You're not going to read about me in the L.A. Times when I die. It's just, I was born in the Ozarks. I come from where the Beverly Hillbillies came from. And yet God has entered in these funny ways through the grief and joy of my life. And that's the thing I think Ruth says to you is, no matter how frustrated or joyful you may be at this moment, there's a kind of hidden hand that's moving along your story and making it significant in ways that you probably won't know until decades down the road you look in the rearview mirror. And so this, I say, is the rhythm of just ordinary loyalty. Boaz, when he is talking to Ruth, says, I've heard about your, my Bible says kindness, but it's the Hebrew word chesed, the steadfast loyalty. I've heard about your chesed. I've heard that you're this loyal person, and he's amazed by it. Not only that, but he says, you, everybody in this town says you are an Eshet Kayil, which is a little Hebrew phrase that's in Proverbs 31, the worthy woman, the noble woman. Well, you want to know what that looks like? He says, Ruth, you are this Eshet Kayil, this noble woman. And it's through the warp and woof of these ordinary lives that God carries this story on. I was going to try to do this so we could be out at quarter after, so I'm going to fast forward a little bit. Lamentations is the third one. In the middle of summer at the 9th of Ab, they'd read Lamentations, which is a series mostly of acrostic poems about grief. The city of Jerusalem has fallen, which looks like God has abandoned us. Hope is over. And so chapter 1 has 22 verses because there are 22 letters in the Greek in the Hebrew alphabet. And so it's kind of like the A to Z of grief. Chapter 2 has 22 verses, another acrostic about grief. Chapter 3 has 66 verses, three for each letter. And chapter 4, another acrostic. Chapter 5 is odd. It has 22 verses, but it's not an acrostic. And to me, having been through horrible grief in my own life, it feels like, I know what that's like. You just can't even keep it together anymore. You'd like to keep some structure in the poetry, but you've lost it. Grief just comes into a place where you can't maintain the order anymore. But in this book, which has been important for sufferers all through history, right in the middle, he says, but the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. And that's the value of this, I think. Again, Eugene Peterson, most of Lamentations is just that, Lamentations, but not all of it. In the center of the laments, there's a pool of light. Pain's chaos gives way to God's faithfulness, that he's going to lament and cry and complain as a faithful person. And so this is the rhythm of grief. An important thing for you. I hope you don't have to go through the big griefs, but you have or will or are going through some kind of grief, some loss in life. And Lamentations believes that even as you move through those faithfully, there is a sense of the joy and love of God. By the way, Friday night is on Lamentations, and one of my dearest friends in the world, right before he turns 80, is going to speak on Lamentations. Landon's a lifelong bachelor, probably the best-known minister in Churches of Christ. In 1969, he left ministry to travel around the world. 1969, he went to all the broken places in the world. And he's going to reflect on what it means to be in the world, believing in the love of God amidst the grief. The fourth one is Ecclesiastes, which maybe is the best known to people in here, I would guess. You've read it or you know the poem. There's a time to be born, a time to die. Or you remember hearing the birds sing it a little bit anyway. But Ecclesiastes is odd. It's odd because, well, first, it's full of the word meaningless. Everything's meaningless, right? And then it's full of a fascination with death. It's always saying, you know what, you're going to die. It's appointed to you to die. There's a death obsession. I've said it's kind of the Billy Crystal of Scripture because, you know, his death obsessions are Woody Allen. It kind of would rephrase this. My wife has been a teacher, and this is kind of, I've seen this on a lot of teachers' desks. 100 years from now, it will not matter what kind of car I drove, what kind of house I lived in, how much money I had, not what my clothes look like, but the world may be a little better because I was important in the life of the child. Here's how Ecclesiastes would rewrite that. 100 years from now, it will not matter what kind of car I drove, what kind of house I lived in, how much money I had, not what my clothes look like, because I'll be dead and so will you. Now that's Ecclesiastes. And so from the very beginning, it's all meaningless. But it's funny, that word hevel, not meaningless is maybe not the best thing, but just smoke. It's all vapor. And an extension from that, if it's vapor, it's an enigma, it's a mystery. I don't know how to figure it out. You kill yourself to get to a certain level of job, and then somebody advances beyond you. Or you get the advancement, and then it's not as satisfying as you thought. Or now that I'm in my 60s, I tend to think of it, or I get it, and then I die. You know, I'm there, you know. And pretty soon, people will pass on, and they'll forget about you and go on. So there's a kind of interesting pause through this book. But I think of Ecclesiastes as a bulldozer. He doesn't like the bumper sticker, all the Christian bumper stickers and the little precious moment bobbleheads and stuff like that. He's not into that. What he likes is honesty. That life is changing. That time and death mean that a lot of the places we're killing ourselves, well, not satisfied. But in the book, there's this constant refrain to have fun, to have joy. Find the things that are good in life. This is the day the Lord has made. Rejoice and be glad in it. And so he's fascinated with mealtime. To enjoy food with your friends. To enjoy life, he says here, with your spouse. To capture this day, to go to work and find in work some bit of joy. Not just punch the clock and go out. Because life, before you know it, you're my age. It's just like, you know, I'm going to wait until the kids are raised. Then I'm going to wait until I get into college. Then I'm going to wait until we pay off college. And then I'm going to wait until I retire. And then you keep waiting and then you die. And you realize, whoa, I forgot to live along the way. And so he's saying, it's difficult because of time and death to figure all of this out, but in each of these days there is joy. There's joy. We tend not to see it. That's why we need children around. My 2-year-old grandson was up at the... No, it was before the crack of dawn. The dawn wasn't even thinking of rising yet. And he saw all the sand outside, and he went, and there was a mound on the sand. And I thought, oh, he's going to build something. Nope, he laid down, took his shirt off, laid down, and rolled down over and over. Got on top again and rolled down until it was just like rolling something in breadcrumbs. You know, he just had it all over. And I thought, yeah, I could probably go through a day and just be so obsessed with worries that I don't even see. Don't see the mountains, don't see the ocean, don't enjoy my friends, don't actually eat a meal. You know, we get pretty proud of the fact that we can go through drive-thru windows and we got a place in there that while we're commuting we can eat and woof it down. And he says, no, sometimes take that meal and cherish it. And in the book, he's concerned about two things. He doesn't think you'll enjoy today's joy because of the past or the future. For older people, he's concerned about the past. You know, it was better in a previous time. You know, the church was better, the country was better. As we get older, we take nostalgia. They're kind of the vacuum cleaner. We go vacuum the past and we clean it up, and then we say, man, we missed the past. Past wasn't that good. But he says in Ecclesiastes 7:10, do not ask how good were the old days. It's not wise to ask that. And for younger people in Ecclesiastes, he's concerned about the future. I won't enjoy today because all my plans are built on what happens when I meet somebody, when I get married, when I move, when I get promoted. And the next thing you know, life just keeps moving along. So I love the wisdom of this book, and I've just called it the rhythm of joy. That in life, I'm going to make sure that each day I capture the joy that is in it. That poem in chapter 3, kind of odd thing. We had a little small group in Abilene, 4 families. And on the same day, our daughter died and one of the other families had a baby born. I mean, what were the odds of that? But in the same hospital, 1 floor apart, the 3rd floor, Megan died. The 4th floor, Arizona Parish was born. And the other 2 families went back and forth and back and forth and back and forth on the same day. And when we got together the next time, what would you say if you were the other families? You know, what would you say with such horrific sadness and such immense joy? And I remember, I'll never forget, one of the guys opened up Ecclesiastes 3 and he just read that poem. There's a time to be born and a time to die, a time for joy and a time for sorrow. And we just kind of sat in the mystery of all of that. And then at the end of the poem it says, but God has put eternity in our hearts to experience the joy of each day. And so we've done our very best, even through some of those torturous days of grief, to find and latch on to the joy. All right, one more, and that is the book of Esther. I've called Esther the rhythm of gratitude. Because they're learning in Esther that salvation is much bigger than just have my sins been forgiven. That's why the subtitle this year is called Scrolls for Robust Salvation. Because in these books you find out, no, salvation is about my sexuality. Salvation is about relationships. Salvation is about eating. Salvation is about friendship. Salvation is about God taking me out of self-destructive places and putting me into health. It's God nurturing me into a way of life that's joyful and loving and committed. So in Esther, this bizarre story of this lunatic king, Xerxes, who in 480 BC tries to do what his dad could not do. You know, he crosses the Hellespont. It's the largest invasion of Europe until D-Day. They put boats back to back. Army goes across from Turkey from Asia Minor over to Greece. And it looks like he's going to win, but they get stopped at Thermopylae by 300 Spartan soldiers. You know the story. 300 soldiers who had courage and apparently perfect abs, if you've ever seen the movie. He goes back. He's in his palace. He's partied for 187 days. And now all these men are drunk. And he asked Queen Vashti to come do a little number to show off her beauty to the drunken men, an offer as nice as it was, she turned down. Said, are you kidding me? And so she's got to be fired as queen. You know, we got to prove the man's in charge here. And that's what all these lunatics around him are saying. They're going to think that men aren't in charge of their families. And the irony is he clearly isn't. You know, Vashti is holding on. She's not going to yield. And so she's fired as queen. They do a search. And it's funny because I've heard people talk about this like there was this big Miss Persia beauty contest, you know, and every little girl's dream was, no, this was sex slavery. It's always in the passive sense. They were taken. They were taken. They went and found physically beautiful women from all over the empire, and they took them back. It was sex trafficking. They got brought back and thrown in the harem. They had one night with the king, and Esther is chosen. This Jewish woman, her Jewish name's Hadassah, she's chosen. And it's, again, not because she trained to be queen her whole life. It's because she happened to have a look that appealed to this beast. But who knows that even in a moment like that, God might use that. And so that's what this story is about. So much so that when it looks like this crazy man named Haman is going to destroy all Jews everywhere in a classic case of overkill, Mordecai, who was like an uncle to Esther, says, you need to go talk to the king. And she reminds him, unless you're summoned by the king, you can be killed. And he says, Esther, it could be that for just a moment like this, you came to this position. Now, it's funny because God's not mentioned in the whole book. The name of God is not in the book of Esther. But listen to how God's there. It could be that you just happened, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you just happened to be there for this moment. And that's when Esther says, fair enough, if I die, I die. And in she goes. And through a series of banquets and stories, she does rescue her people, the Jewish people. And then at the end, they mark the celebration of Purim because it came from the rolling of the dice to find when they would all die, but they were all saved by God. Well, that's my Reader's Digest summary of five amazing books. I've spent my life thinking about these books, and this year in particular, so it was a little hard to choose. I just want to give a feel for that. And to think that even in our lives, on this campus, there's such amazing things that are happening. And sometimes God's front and center and we tell God's stories, but other times it may feel distant and God forsaken. A time of grief, a time of doubt. But who knows? But what those may be the very moments that your loyalty, when tested, becomes the very avenue to growth for you or for others. And I've seen it happen again and again. Well, thank you so much for coming. We didn't need to do anything else here, did we? We're done. I don't know. Am I in charge? I guess I can. Yeah. Yeah. Does anybody want, I think it did say Q&A. Does anybody want to ask any questions? Ask a really hard one. I've seen a few of our religion faculty walk in, so I will defer to them. It'll be fun. Anybody have any questions about the theme, lectureship, these five books? Why I'm choosing to live in Abilene rather than Malibu. I mean, there are all kinds of relevant things. I would have to show a picture of the three grandkids to explain that one. Anyone else? Okay, we've got some refreshments outside, so thank you very much for coming. Thank you, HR, for hosting this, and I hope you guys come. Thank you.